Thank you. You may be seated, kids. You are dismissed off to Ridge Kids this morning. If you go into the lobby, their leaders will meet you there. A happy Mother's Day to you on this gorgeous, gorgeous weekend in May. Finally feels like summer has arrived, which is a good thing, good thing. Well, today we're going to start a new series in the Gospel of John. Gospel, if you're not familiar with that term, simply means a biography of Jesus' life. It tells us about who he is, who he was, what he did, and how he acted. And the gospel that we're looking at is the one that the Apostle John wrote. He was there. He witnessed it. He saw Jesus, his death, and his resurrection. And so we've been kind of slowly working through the Gospel of John on and off over the last year and a half or so. And so we're going to pick up again in John chapter 8. Last week, I was reading an article about a man named Vito Perone. Vito Perone was a very successful high school principal in a school district in Massachusetts in the United States. After finishing working there, he took a job as an interim superintendent at a nearby school district. And then, because he was deeply loved in the school district that he'd worked in for many years, because he was highly qualified and well-suited for the job, the committee that was seeking a new superintendent for the area that he'd been in, the school district that he'd been in, invited him to apply for the job of superintendent, which he did. And they liked him so much that they formally offered him the job. But then they began a negotiation around compensation. And in one of the emails that he wrote to the committee, he addressed some of the women in that committee as ladies. Now, he did that without any bad intent whatsoever. But the ladies, the women in that group were deeply offended. They felt that it was a microaggression against them. And as a result, they said he should have known about this. And they withdrew the offer of the contract and gave it to someone else. It is a fascinating example of what is known these days as cancel culture. And you probably know about cancel culture. But in case that term is new to you, cancel culture is the idea of publicly shaming somebody in order to punish them for actions or beliefs that are out of line with a certain opinion or ideology. And usually that takes place on social media, and the goal is to shame someone, but often the consequences are much greater than that. Often someone ends up with their reputation in tatters, their career stalled, or worse, job offers rescinded, or even losing their job. And the significance of those consequences for not acting in line with the expected attitudes and actions of those who are canceling them are usually quite significant. And if you've heard about or seen this happen, if it's happened to you, you know there's this raging debate about it, right? There are those who, on the one hand, say that it is a necessary way to hold people to account for their actions. And there are those, on the other hand, who say, no, it stifles free speech. It punishes people for making choices and decisions that some group of people have randomly decided are acceptable or not acceptable. But that's what cancel culture is. And in the story we're going to look at today is all about cancel culture. Because it turns out that this is not something new in our society. This is something that has gone on for thousands of years. It also turns out that some of the people who practice it most commonly are the religious crowd. And so today, in the story we're going to look at, Jesus comes face to face with cancel culture. And it's fascinating to see how he responds, because if we're following in his footsteps, his response should inform our response. So here's the situation again. It begins in John chapter 8, the beginning. It says this: "Then they," the people, "all went home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?' They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him." So Jesus is standing in the courtyard. It's the morning time. The crowds have gathered for him to teach them. And in the middle of this barges in the religious leaders. With this woman in tow, they sort of set him in front of her like she's on trial. And they say, this woman was accused of adultery. Not accused, we caught her in adultery. We know this. And the law says that she should be stoned. Jesus, what do you say? Look, you want to talk about cancel culture? This is the ultimate cancel culture, isn't it? I mean, the response for stepping across what was agreed in that day and for the most part in our day, an unacceptable line, was to stone her to death. Now, of course, we look at that today and we say, that's outrageous. I mean, who would even consider doing something like that? But it turns out that in our world today, Christians are still involved in all kinds of cancel culture. It's just much more subtle and obviously nowhere near as violent. But for instance, I know of Christians who have canceled a worship song and sometimes a church with the worship song because even though there was nothing theologically wrong with that particular worship song, it was written by somebody who went to a church that they didn't like the theology of that church. And they were worried that if the church sang that worship song, someone would look up who that person was, begin to listen to that other church and get bad theology. And so therefore, they not only canceled the song, they left a church that they loved and knew over something like that. Christians sometimes cancel Christian leaders over things that they have said or done or wrote. And those leaders are no longer invited to speak at their conferences. Their book, even though it was well written and highly regarded before, suddenly can't be read, can't be quoted from, can't be shared with anyone else. They cancel Christian leaders. There are Christians who cancel others over their political positions. Other Christians or other people take political positions that they find unacceptable, and so they cut those people out of their world, out of their life. There are Christians who cancel other Christians over their sins. Sometimes it's Christian leaders that are canceled. Sometimes it's people that they know personally in their life. Sometimes it's people that they just kind of know and understand that they did something, and so they are out. They're canceled. Christians are certainly not immune to practicing cancel culture. So the question is why? Why is it? What is it that would motivate good Christian people to cancel other people in their life? And I think there are a number of reasons why we are sometimes tempted to this. One of the reasons is fear. A fear that if we don't respond or react to the sin in someone else's life, to what they did, that it will look like we are soft on sin, or even that we condone it, right? I mean, this was the trap for Jesus, wasn't it? Jesus has been going to a lot of parties with tax collectors, sinners. And the fascinating thing is wherever Jesus went, these prostitutes kept showing up. One breaking a glass bottle of expensive perfume over his head. Another showing up and weeping on his feet and drying his feet with her hair. And now this woman who was caught in adultery is right here. And the question is, Jesus, are you going to say something? Or are you soft on sexual sin? Maybe you condone it. Jesus, maybe you got something going on in your life that you're not telling us about. Right? I mean, Christians, sometimes it's fear that drives them, sometimes loudly, sometimes publicly, to cancel someone else so that they don't look soft on sin. Or worse, as if they condone it. Sometimes people do this because they're fearful of what others will think of them. A second reason why some Christians are tempted to practice cancel culture is they desire to control how others act. They begin to think, look, if somebody does this kind of sin and nobody says something and they get away with it and they do it with impunity, maybe they'll do it again. And if no one says something, maybe others will think, oh, I guess that's okay. And maybe they'll do it and soon everyone will do it. And we can't have that. So the response is to say, let's make an example of that person. Let's show everyone, this is what will happen if you cross this line. And they desire to control how other people act. Third reason why sometimes Christians cancel others is that they're hurt. They trusted that person. They looked up to that person. That person was a role model for them, a spiritual leader in their life. And they went and did something that crushed their trust in them. And so they're hurt by their actions. It's another reason why Christians sometimes cancel others. And then there's one more reason. Sometimes Christians practice cancel culture because they are self-righteous. You know, it's easy. We have a tendency to vilify the sins that we're least likely to commit. And when someone does something that we would never dream of doing, we're quick to say, I can't believe that someone would do that. How dare they? And then we get into canceling them. Of course, when it's our sin, it's different, right? I mean, when we fly off the handle in anger, or we end up looking at porn late at night by ourselves, or we end up, you know, belittling the person at the cash register because they can't seem to get it right, that's wrong, it's bad, we know, but it's different. I mean, we're tired, we're stressed, we're hungry, they provoked us. We're really quick to judge others, to cancel others, but we're also quite quick to rationalize our own sins. And often, when we're self-righteous, we make judgments based on a singular action that someone else has done. You know, their whole life, everything else that they have done doesn't matter. Even what's going on for them in the moment doesn't matter, often because the self-righteous don't know. I mean, take, for example, a 16-year-old boy who comes out, who tells his folks that he's gay. The response from the self-righteous is to cancel. They would never be like that. Plus, it's wrong. And if they don't come out and condemn it, maybe it looks like they're soft on this thing, on sin. And maybe others will think it's okay. So it requires a firm response. But the self-righteous make their judgment based only on one piece of information. And one that they know only from a distance. And they never even bother to find out what else is going on. You know, what the self-righteous don't know is that 16-year-old boy has experienced unwanted same-sex attraction for 3 years. And he stayed up night after night trying to pray it away. And he's got up early in the morning and begged God to change this situation in his life. And he shed countless tears about it. He struggled alone with anxiety and depression, shame and confusion and doubt and fear. For 3 years, he hasn't told anybody. And it's eating him up on the inside. And finally, after many long agonizing nights, he decides that he is going to tell his folks or his youth leaders or somebody else in the church that he knows and trusts. And he's terrified. I mean, what is their response going to be? Are they going to condemn him? Are they going to reject him? Or will they hopefully accept him and walk with him on the journey that is surely before him? See, the self-righteous, they consider none of that. They're simply quick to judge and quick to condemn, and they've got the stones already in their hands. They're just waiting for the chance. But not Jesus. You know, here's how Jesus responds to the pressure in his life in front of all this watching crowd with this woman who very clearly was an adulteress. Here's how he responds to the pressure to cancel her. John tells us what happens. He says this, "But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger." Jesus just slows the whole thing down. He doesn't rush into anything. He doesn't begin to argue with the religious leaders. He doesn't interrogate the woman in front of her, in front of him to try to find out more information. He just like, whoa, let's slow this whole thing down. And he just bends over and begins to draw in the dirt on the ground because he won't be drawn into their trap. But they are impatient. And so here's what happens next. "When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, 'Let any one of you who is without sin be first to throw a stone at her.' Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground." Jesus stands up, he says, "You're right. She's an adulteress. She knows it. You know it. I know it. We all know it. So, whoever's without sin, throw the first stone. After that, the rest of you feel free to join in." And see, it's brilliant Jesus, isn't it? I mean, Jesus is just so brilliant in all that he does. He questions them in order to help them become self-aware, to look at their sins, to judge others, only after experiencing the humility that comes from looking within themselves. See, self-awareness is an important skill in life, especially if you're a follower of Jesus. You should be self-aware. Being self-aware is a sign of maturity, and it will rescue you from profound hypocrisy. I mean, I maybe this happened to you. I was sitting around the table with all the kids. We're having a nice meal, supper time. One of my kids reaches for something, knocks over a full glass of water. There's water everywhere. People are jumping out of the way. It's spilling everywhere. I'm like, please, pay attention. Be careful. And as I get up to get a cloth to clean up their mess, I look down to see a tomato stain running from here to here. Mid-50s, still can't get all the food from my plate into my mouth without leaving some here, right? Oh, we're quick to judge others. We're quick to cancel and forget that we have all kinds of sin in our own lives. I mean, Jesus warns of this very thing in another place. He says this, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." Here's the question. How self-aware are you of the sin in your life? If I were to ask you, and I won't, but if I were to ask you to take out a piece of paper and a pen and to list two or three main areas of sin in your life that you struggle with, that you wrestle with, could you do that? Or you'd be like, well, sometimes I get a little upset sometimes when I shouldn't. No. That's an easy pass. What is the area in your life that you struggle with in sin? Is it pride? Do you have an ego that's so tender that if somebody just presses a little bit on it, you fly into a rage? Is envy your problem? You're always comparing yourself to others, always hoping that their world goes less well so that you feel better about yourself? Is it controlling others? Do you always want to control everyone around you so that their world is under your control? I mean, what is it? Is it lust? Is it greed that you just always want more stuff? Is it deceit? Do you manipulate people? Are you even aware of the sin in your life? And is there someone in your life that you trust enough that if they told you or pointed out to you, that you could hear it from them? And when it is told to you and when it is pointed out to you, do you hear it? When it comes out in a big fight with your spouse and they say, "You are..." Or through a difficult conversation with your boss, or in an argument with your brother or sister. When that happens, do you just write off what they say? Do you just defend yourself and fire back? Oh yeah, well you got this. Do you ignore what they have to say? And probably, I'll bet you do, because that's my response. That's the kind of average, normal thing that we do. The question is this: afterwards, when the heat is off, the fight is done, the hard conversation has been had, you have the courage and the humility to say, that part they said in anger, that doesn't matter. But this part, there's a kernel of truth in this. I need to pay attention. It's one of the ways that I become self-aware, by listening to what is said and saying, oh, this is a thing in my life. See, if you can do that, it's not a sign of weakness in your life. It's a sign of maturity. And the better you are at doing it, the more aware that you are of the sin and the shortfalls in your life, the greater the grace and mercy that you extend to others. And this is really important for two reasons. The first is this, because when you can extend grace and mercy instead of judgment and condemnation, when you don't simply resort to canceling someone out of your life or out of your world because of something that they've done, it allows your relationship with them to continue. And you know, it's in the context of the relationship that you grow and they grow. You think you cut them off and that'll teach them they'll change? No, of course not. It's when you maintain that relationship and continue to walk together that the growth comes in your life and in their life. But there's a second reason why it's so important that we extend grace and mercy to others in their sin and their shortfalls. Because when the sin and shortfalls in your life come out, the way you've treated them is how they're going to treat you. Jesus says as much. Here's what he says. "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you'll be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." But it's not just how others are going to judge you when you fall and sin, and you will, because we all do. It's also how God is going to judge you. Listen to what James writes. There will be no mercy for those who have not shown mercy to others. But if you have been merciful, God will be merciful when he judges you. You know, those verses should sober you. The next time that you decide that you want to cancel someone, you want to write them off from your world, those verses should ring in your head. You should bend down and write them in the dust at your feet or in your journal or look them up on your phone, and you should think long and hard before you decide that you're going to cancel someone or condemn them. It's so important how you respond to the sins of others. Jesus says to the religious leaders, whoever is without sin should throw the first stone. And here's what happens next. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said, but neither do I condemn you. Look, the woman standing before him clearly was an adulteress. Everyone knew it. Jesus knew it. And the only person in that circle, of all the people standing there, the only person who was without sin, the only one who could have picked up a stone to start it all, was Jesus. But he didn't. He wouldn't dream of it. He says, I don't condemn you. See, here's the point. Jesus doesn't do cancel culture. He doesn't fear what people will say that somehow he's soft on sin because he didn't condemn them. So that means that if we're following him, we shouldn't have that fear either. And he doesn't try to control them and punish them for what they did. So it's the height of arrogance if he didn't do it, if you and I think that it's up to us to punish someone for their sins, for what they did. And he's not self-righteous, and so we shouldn't either. Jesus doesn't do cancel culture. And so if we're followers of Jesus, we shouldn't do cancel culture either. Jesus says to the woman standing there, I don't condemn you. So beautiful. You know, when you've sinned, when there's some part of your life that you're like, man, I just messed this up so much. Or maybe you think, in my whole life, I've messed it up. And you look around and there's all these people kind of jittery, waiting to throw stones and judge you. You know who wouldn't dream of it? Jesus, he loves you. He doesn't condemn you. He doesn't condemn this woman. But, and this is really important to note, he doesn't just say, I don't condemn you. Okay, on your way. He adds one more line. Here's what he says at the very end. He says, go now and leave your life of sin, which is really important. Because you see, when there's sin in people's lives, one of the ways that we can deal with it is the cancel culture. To be like, that's it, you'd cross the line, you're out. But there's another option that's kind of the far opposite extreme. It's victim culture. It's to say, well, you're a victim of your circumstances. All these things happen. You can't be held responsible for your sin, so don't worry about it. And in Jesus' case, he could have done that. I mean, you know in that day that women had hardly any rights at all. I mean, they had very little rights in that culture whatsoever. And do you find it interesting to note that there isn't a man standing there beside her, right? I mean, isn't that interesting? You know, adultery is a two-person event, and the same punishment was due to the man as to the woman, but there was no man there. What's that about? Did he get away, or did he get away? And maybe her husband was mean and difficult and ignored her. Maybe he drove her into the arms of another man. And very clearly, the religious leaders were using her situation in their vendetta against Jesus. She was a pawn in their power games. And Jesus could have let her off the hook. He could have said, hey, given your circumstances, given, you know, the way this society is built, don't worry about it. But he doesn't. He knows much of this, maybe all of it, and yet he doesn't treat her like a helpless victim. He doesn't treat her like a little child with no control over life and therefore no responsibility for her actions. Instead, he treats her with the deepest of respect. He treats her as you should any adult, as someone who is responsible for their actions and who can change and who can choose to live differently. And so therefore, he says to her, go and sin no more. See, the second thing that we need to see here is that Jesus doesn't do victim culture. Many people try to live in the realm of victim culture. They justify their sins by saying, like, my mother was controlling when I was a kid, or my father was emotionally distant, or the system is stacked against me, or my past experiences are part of my problem, or my current experiences, or you know, I was born this way, or they justify it because the powerful, you know, the man who should have been there, he's not there, so why am I being punished when others aren't being punished? Why should they be held responsible for what they did? They say that they're a victim, and so they shouldn't be blamed for their actions, for the sin in their life. Now look, that doesn't mean that there aren't real circumstances that play out in our lives, in the lives of others. There are real circumstances that have real impact upon our lives. It also doesn't mean that we shouldn't work to deal with the injustices in this world. One of the things that God has called us to is to deal with injustice in this world. But what it does mean is that we accept responsibility for our own sins, regardless of what has happened to us or is happening to us. And it means that we treat others with respect and with dignity, not as someone to be pitied because they have no control in their life or over their life or because they're a victim, but as someone who is responsible for their actions and therefore capable of dealing with the sins in their life. Jesus doesn't do victim culture. And he doesn't do cancel culture. So if he doesn't do either of those, then what is the way of Jesus? Well, the way of Jesus is the way of grace and truth. Jesus extends both incredible grace to people, but he also gently and firmly speaks the truth. It's the Jesus way. It's Jesus culture. It's the kind of culture that we want to have here at this church. So let's agree that here, at this church, at Ridge Church, that we aren't doing cancel culture. We're not cancel culturing people out there, and we're not cancel culturing people in here. Because if we do, if we get that kind of culture going, then how will we ever have the kind of freedom to tell one another about the real struggles and the real sins in our life so that people can come alongside us and care for us and walk with us and encourage us and strengthen us as we follow Jesus? See, a church that has cancel culture going, in that kind of a church, everyone, from the pastor on down, has to act like they've got it all together. That there's no sin in their world, that there's no messiness going on, that everything is good because they follow Jesus and that's what should be for good Christians. And they see each other on Sunday and they smile and then they go home the rest of their week and desperately try to work through the problems all by themselves. And as they're at home, they think, I must be the only Christian in this place, in this church, who struggles with these things. I must be a terrible Christian. That's not us. This place here, we are filled with sinners. You're a sinner. I'm a sinner. We all have made mistakes that have left us in bad places. Choices that we wish that we could take back. Sins that we struggle with in our lives. And so we are not going to become a place of cancel culture. If you think, hey, you know what? I'm just going to go home and solve these problems on my own. You can try. It's pretty tough to do. The best way is to find a few other people around here that you trust and to get real and say, look, I got these things. Let's walk together as we follow Jesus. They need you in their life and you need them in your life. We're not going to do cancel culture. But let's also agree around here in this church that we're not going to do victim culture either. That when someone has the courage and the humility to say to you, this is the sin in my life, this is an area that I struggle in, that you don't give in to the temptation to say, oh, it's okay. It's really hard for you and it's no problem. Don't worry about it. That instead, you listen. You say, oh man, I can't believe how hard that must be. I understand the circumstances in your life. But let's walk together as we follow after Jesus. Let's seek to live differently, to deal with the sin in our lives. See, that's Jesus culture. That's the kind of culture that we want in this place. It allows us to find freedom and growth through the work of Jesus in our lives as we walk together with one another in true community. It's the kind of church we want to be. So that someone who has had an abortion and that has never told anyone and that thing weighs so heavily on them and is slowly burning them up can finally say to a few friends, this happened in my life. It's killing me. And those people say, look, we don't condemn you. We got our own stuff. Let's follow Jesus together. So that in our church, a 16-year-old boy who has been struggling for 3 years with same-sex attraction can come and tell his parents or his youth leaders or someone else in the church and say, look, and we say, look, we don't condemn you. We got other stuff that we're working on. Let's follow Jesus together. So that a mother who is drinking more and more and more because of the pressures in her life could tell some of the other mothers in her world, look, this is a thing, without fearing that they're going to recoil and withdraw and pull away. But instead they say, we don't condemn you. We got our own stuff. Let's follow Jesus together. So that a husband and father who knows that when he gets in a rage, he begins to say and do things that he shouldn't say or do. Share with a couple other guys. They say, it's okay. We're gonna walk with you. We're going to help you be accountable to follow what Jesus calls you to do in your life. See, here's what we say about our church, that this church, our church, Ridge Church, is a school for sinners, not a sanctuary for saints. We're a community of people who are seeking to follow Jesus, not perfectly, not nearly perfectly, but as best as we can. And where our sins and our failures and our regrets don't define who we are. But at the same time, where we're called to change and grow and find new direction and hope through the power of the Holy Spirit in our life. Grace and grit. That's what we're about. That's what Jesus does for this woman. The religious leaders drag her before him. And instead of condemning her, he redeems the sin in her life. Her place of greatest shame becomes the place of greatest mercy. The story that she would have never wanted to tell anyone, that she wished she could just sweep it under the rug and never mention again, became the story that she couldn't help but tell everyone because of what Jesus did in her life. Instead of being canceled, Jesus took and redeemed and repurposed this very thing in her life. He defends her when she's covered with shame. And looks her in the eye and says, I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more. That's who we follow. That's how we're called to live in light of who Jesus is.